back to the final part of our program today. Now, our next guest knew that he wanted to be a pop star at a very early age after seeing Cliff Richard and the Shads enjoying their summer holiday all out and about. However, unlike most children with such dreams, he went on to make them a reality. Teaming up with his future songwriting partner, Chris Difford, and Jules Holland, in the 70s that was, they formed the band Squeeze, and then they went on to enjoy enormous chart success with hits like Cool for Cats and Up the Junction. Well, after 25 years in the business, he decided to go it alone, and has just released his first solo single, which he has called Parallel World. So straight from finishing his British tour, will you please welcome Glenn Tilbrook. Hi, how are you?
Good, how's it going?
So how strange was it then, you know, crashing out on your own, going around the country, having been used to being in bands for 25 years?
Well, you know, I sort of eased myself in slowly by, I started doing solo dates, I suppose, about 8 or 9 years ago. Originally, I started out doing it with a band, and then the band devolved to just me, which was easier to plan from my point of view. And I found I enjoyed a lot. I enjoyed a lot the freedom from set lists, ability to make it up as you go along and to improvise. And to talk to an audience.
Yes, and also being in control of the whole thing. I mean, being ultimately responsible for everything.
Yeah.
It's quite a good feeling.
I like that feeling very much. And I like, you know, more than anything, I like making up as I go along.
That's good.
Yeah.
Like we do here every day.
Exactly.
Now, listen, when you were young, I gather you liked a bit of attention from an extremely early age. So how old are we talking about here?
Well, as far back as I can remember, I always liked singing. And I did used to go and knock on my neighbours' doors and sing to them.
But make them listen.
Make them listen, apparently. They sort of used to reward me with sweets or something. I don't know if that was my ulterior motive at the time, but that's what I used to do. And then the sort of ultimate catalyst for me wanting to be a musician was, as you say, me singing Summer Holiday, which when I saw Cliff and the Shads on a double-decker bus getting out and playing and people dancing around them, I thought, that's just too good to miss. That's what I want to do. And I never changed my mind.
And so you've been living the dream ever since?
Well, for the past couple of years, rather belatedly, I've hired a double-decker bus on my birthday and sort of gone around.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I have, yeah. It's great.
Seriously?
I get out and play sometimes.
The neighbours say, oh gosh, here he comes again, you know, let's all hide.
They're going to knock on my neighbours' doors, you know, give me a couple.
So having had all those guitar and piano lessons and everything when you were young, I always think that you have to have very supportive parents, you know, to pay for it all. And were they musical in themselves?
They weren't musical. I didn't actually, I didn't have lessons. What happened is that there was a piano in the house. And they bought me a guitar when I was 7, because my interest was still keen post summer holiday. And I had someone who taught me how to tune the guitar, and then I was left to my own devices with it, and that was a good thing for me, because I could learn at my own rate. I didn't have anyone I wanted to sound like. I didn't want to be like Jimi Hendrix or Eric Clapton. I just enjoyed the playing of it. So by the time I did want to sound like Jimi Hendrix, and there did come a time when I did, I couldn't do that, but I had the ability to sort of, you know, sound like a very distant facsimile of Jimi Hendrix.
And we must talk about Jules Holland, of course, we really know, and Chris Difford. Now, how did you meet up with Chris initially?
Chris had put an advert in a sweet shop window in Blackheath requesting a guitarist for a band that had a recording contract and a tour of Europe that was imminent. And this was when I was 15, and this looked just absolutely ideally what I wanted. So I answered the ad, and met Chris, and it was all a complete tissue of lies. No band, no recording contract, no tour of Europe. But there was Chris, who had already written some marvellous songs. And I'd been writing by myself at that point. And so Chris and I started writing within about 3 months of meeting each other. And
did that feel good? I mean, did he feel like a natural partner to write with?
He felt like a natural partner because he was very gifted. At that point, he was a very gifted and continues to be a very gifted lyricist. And that wasn't an area at that time I was particularly strong in. I was more of a melody bloke. So we actually, by the time we started writing, it was a very natural conclusion to what we would end up doing together.
When I look back over the amount of albums that Squeeze made, it seemed that you were always busy and of course had great hits, but in a way always looking for the niche, never quite fitting. Like, for example, in the punk era, a lot of people thought you were punk, but you weren't.
Always looking for the niche is a very good way of putting it, actually. It's I don't think that we ever really completely slotted into anything that, you know, any movement. And in the long term, that worked both for and against us. It worked for us in the sense that I think we avoided being pigeonholed, and we were able to do our own thing for quite an extraordinarily long time certainly by the terms of the turnover of the business today. Firstly, it worked against us though because people weren't sure what we were. Our image was never that strong. It was never really something that we were that bothered about. And I think, you know, in retrospect, that wasn't really particularly helpful to us.
I must say, I'd like to hear your comments about the image after we look at this. I love it, actually. Oh. It was a great hit for you. Cool for Cats, and here it is.
The swing is doing 90 because they've got nowhere to go. They get a gang of villains in a shed up at Heathrow. They're counting out the fibres when the handcuffs lock again. In and out of Wandsworth with the numbers on their names. It's funny how the missus always looks a bleeding sane. And meanwhile at the station there's a couple of likely lads who swear like how's your father, and they're very cool for Cats, they're cool for Cats.
There you were in the back in your red jacket.
That's right. And I was under the impression that I was moving in a panther-like fashion, sort of supremely sexy, and it was a bit of a jolt to see the video, actually.
So did you actually have, you know, lots of moments where you were all sort of trying to vie for the image, or what's the image going to be, or what are we going to perform in, what are we going to make the videos in?
I think Jules is the only one of us that ever had a very strong visual sense, and the rest of us were really not preoccupied with that, and we just sort of tumbled into what we did. The thing that we were preoccupied with was the songwriting and the actual sound of the band. That's what we're always about, I think.
Well, it's been a fascinating career and lots of changes for you, but still great enthusiasm, which is what I like.
Yeah.
And of course, you're going to hear the new single at the end of the program.
Oh, yes.
But for the moment, Glenn, thank you very much indeed. Glenn Tilbrook. Our next guest's love of music also began at a very early age, but he soon realised that maybe his talents lay somewhere other than singing, and he began writing songs for the likes of Cliff, whom we've been talking about, David Essex and Leo Sayer. But he's probably best known as a DJ, having won 10 National Broadcaster of the Year awards for his programmes on Radio 1 and, of course, Classic FM. But his latest project combines his enthusiasm for the songwriting process along with his encyclopedia-type knowledge of popular music. Now, it's called his new book, From Major to Minor, and a chronicles the history of the songwriter from his first professional exponents through to the impact of modern technology. Here he is, Mike Reed. Hi, Mike. Good to see you. Thank you. Have you met
Glenn
before?
Many times.
Good. Yes, we've all played Squeeze many times in our past as DJs.
Yes, the first Squeeze record I remember playing was Cat on a Wall. When I was on local radio.
Yeah, that's going before back the extreme.
Wasn't exactly yesterday. No. Now listen, in terms of songwriting, we know obviously you've had a lot of things recorded and you've written musicals yourself, etc. But what's your individual fascination with the songwriter?
I've always loved writing songs from an early age. I've loved words, I love music. And for me, I bought records because of songwriters. I looked to see who'd written them. I thought they must be good. There were two guys that I mentioned in the book that they wrote a lot of Elvis songs. They wrote things like The Young Ones for Cliff, When the Girl in Your Arms. And there are two guys called Sid Tepper and Roy Bennett. And they're both 83. They're still alive. And I tracked them down for the book to talk to them.
And still writing?
They're still, no, they're not really writing now. But I said to them, I was talking to them, I said, I used to look for your names on the record. You know, and if it was Tepper and Bennett, I thought, it's got to be good. I mean, they wrote G.I. Blues and stuff like that as well.
Yeah. It's fun. In my own little way, I used to do the same thing about Jimmy Kennedy, the songwriter who wrote Red Sails in the Sunset and South of the Border and so on.
Yeah.
Because he came from Ireland. Of course, I was fascinated that anybody from Ireland had such huge success worldwide. Yeah. But he was a good songwriter as well.
Yeah, there are so many good writers. I mean, Glenn is right that he and Chris were really a songwriting band. I always felt that at the time. They were, rather than an image band, very much a songwriting band.
When did you actually start to write when you were a kid?
When I was 11 was when I wrote my first song. And they used to have record songbooks, and I used to put my own tunes to the songs that I didn't know. It's a great way to start.
It is. It's a great way of writing, isn't it?
And you, Mike, in terms of your own writing?
I always written poetry, and then I'd always put melody to them, you know, on guitar when I first started playing guitar. I never wanted to be Eric Clapton. I always wanted to be a songwriter. So I became a rhythm guitarist, much looked down upon, because I didn't want to play the fancy bits. I wanted to write songs. So as soon as I could play chords and different rhythms and all the rest of it, then I wanted to write, and that was it for me.
Was it your gran as well who actually passed down quite a lot of knowledge about you know, songs and various bits of music that you inherited?
Yeah, I think you hear your parents around the house and your grandparents whistling and humming things. And you think they all come from, because you're about four or five or three, you think they're all from just before you were born, really. But some of them were 100 years old. You know, when I heard my grandmother singing stuff, I thought, oh, you know, must be a new song.
But that's what I'd like to talk about with the two of you today. You know, what makes a good song that is going to live on for future generations, for example? Now, because you've written as a band for a band, in a way, give me an example of a song that you feel wouldn't really be of particular interest to anybody else, just for you.
I would think one of the songs we wrote was Up the Junction, and I think that's a very... That's probably the opposite of what I would call a universal song. It's.
Would you play a little bit of it?
Yeah, sure.
I never liked to see a guitar going
to waste. Well, I have to say, it's not because Glenn's here, that this is truly a great pop song. I mean, for me, they're good writers, but the three bands would be Cool for Cats, Up the Junction, and Labelled with Love was another great song.
That's probably less specific, but it's a little bit of
Up the Junction then.
I never thought it would happen with me and the girl from Clapham. I don't know where they come, and that night I ain't forgotten. Was she the other rations, with some of the passions? I said, you are a lady. Perhaps she said, I may be.
I always love the rhyming process of the words there. The lyrics are terrific. They're very good.
The only pop song with incubator in it. Oh, that's great.
Now, Baby Love is one of the tracks that we picked out for you because you like this one, don't you, Diana Ross?
It wasn't particularly. It was to demonstrate. I mean, Holland Dozier Holland are in the book. And they were basically three young guys. I mean, you know, probably on Workers, you thought, oh, Holland Dozier Holland. They're three great old guys from Motown. But they're only young boys, really, when they were writing these songs. Much like Stock Aitken Waterman. And people say, oh, don't mention them in the same breath. But they were very similar, writing songs for young people with seasoned musicians. I mean, that's what Holland Dozier Holland did. They went in the studio, and these old guys are saying, hey, we want you to make it really sort of flash and slick here, and we can do this. They go, no, man, just make it basic. We can do more than that. No, that's what we want for the kids. And that's what Stock Aitken Waterman did as well.
Do you think that Stock Aitken Waterman would be looked on in the same light as Holland Dozier in Holland in the future?
You mean eventually?
Yeah.
Probably not, but they were in the same vein as much as they had phenomenal success for young kids at the time, which Motown did. Maybe Motown was a bit more varied.
Was there a format for Motown? I mean, just like a format that the writers just say, our sound, this is what we stick to, and of course so many people had hits with it.
They had different writers. I mean, Holland Dozier Holland were the mainstay of the Motown writers, but there were other writers as well. But they had different techniques, I think, they used without being boring. I think they sort of directly injected the instrument sometimes for the first time and got different sounds, like Phil Spector did.
I want to see a little bit of the clip, actually, from Diana Ross and the Supremes, and here it is. Extraordinary, isn't it? When you look at videos these days and how flash they are and how inventive, and yet you look at that, so basic, it's unbelievable.
They weren't fashion gurus, were they, really? that, again, a great song. And when they did Where Did Our Love Go, just before that, it was a toss-up whether Diana Ross, or Diane as she was then, or Mary Wilson sang the song. And Holland Dozier Holland argued between them as to who should sing the song. And Diana won out.
Lucky for her. Now listen, just in the minute that we have left before Glenn gives us his new single, what is it, do you think, that makes a song great, that gives it longevity, and that maybe, say, in generations to come, we'll still be listening to it or humming it or whatever?
It's difficult. It's one of those intangible things, a song, that just comes from somewhere. For me, it's when the words and the music absolutely marry, and that great melody could not belong to another lyric, or vice versa. I don't know whether you agree with that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, for me, it's whether it has a heart in it or not, whether there's some heart and soul. Mm. I think that was the difference for me between Stock Aitken Waterman and Holland Dozier and Holland, for my personal taste.
Well, you know what, Glenn? It's time for you to do it. So this is the new single. Will you just welcome Glenn Tilbrook? Yes.